Whoever you are, wherever you come from, whoever you love, we welcome you. We're especially happy to have you join us today. My name is Dave Clements, and I serve as the intern minister. And I am joined today by Lisa Thiel, one of our worship associates, Hal Walker, our director of music, and Anya Johnson has a part in our program today as well.
I've got a recipe for spring.
I've got a recipe for spring.
And it's making me wanna sing.
And it's making me wanna sing.
'Cause everywhere that I go.
Tolerance. See through eyes of compassion. Speak with the language of love. Several years ago, my son was just beginning to take upright bass lessons, and I, being the good parent, dutifully forced him to engage in his half hour of daily practice as instructed by his teacher. It did not take long for this to become a pretty big source of contention in our house. But in the face of his resistance, I grew more firm because I knew this was right. Of course, kids don't really want to practice. They need to be pushed. The more he argued, the more I pushed. I was so busy trying to force onto him what I knew to be right. And this discord went on for quite a while until I reached the point of desperation and began seeking an alternative approach. I softened my edges and let go of my expectations and my demands. I took several long, deep, slow breaths and asked him, with all openness of heart, "What do you think we should do?" And it was then that he told me about the difficulty he has dealing with the concept of time. Watching the clock until the 30 minutes were up created tremendous stress and distraction. So my 9-year-old proposes a how many rather than how long approach, that I should specify the number of each piece and scales that he was to practice. And the results were extraordinary. This vastly enhanced the peace in our home, and I think we both really grew from the experience. Not only did my son find something that, you know, quite simply worked better for him and helped him improve his musical ability, more importantly, he was seen and he was heard. And I got the special lesson that I wasn't always right, no matter how convinced that I was, and that I could learn a thing or two from my child. By listening to the deeper story behind the confrontation, together we came up with a successful solution. What would happen if we always looked for the deeper story behind any confrontation with anyone we disagree with? What solutions could we come up with together? And what growth is possible? Come, let us worship together. We are biological beings that really need the support of others. May we always feel and sense the support of our community. May we be buoyed up by the support in our times of need. And may we always feel the sense of shared happiness in our celebrations. May we always feel a sense of oneness that we share, and may that give us some protection and hope in all times.
A small thing once happened at school that brought up a question in me. Somehow it brought me to see the price that I pay to be cool. Diane is a girl that I know. She's strange, she doesn't belong. I don't mean to say that it's wrong. We don't like to be with her though. So when we all made a plan, have this big party at Sue's, most kids in our school got the news, but no one invited Diane. The thing about Taft Junior High is secrets don't last very long. I acted like nothing was wrong when I saw Diane start to cry. I know you may think that I'm cruel. It doesn't make me very proud. I just went along with the crowd. It's sad, but you have to in school. You can't pick the friends you prefer. You fit in as well as you can. I couldn't be friends with Diane, 'cause then they would treat me like her. In one class at Taft Junior High, we study what people have done with gas chamber, bomber, and gun at Auschwitz, Beijing, and Milan. I don't understand all I learn. Sometimes I sit there and cry. The whole world stood idly by to watch as the innocent burned. Like robots obeying some rule, atrocities done by the mob, all innocents doing their job. And what was it for? was it cool? The world was aware of this hell, but how many cried out in shame? What heroes and who was to blame? A story no one dared to tell. I promise to do what I can to not let it happen again. To care for all women and men, I'll start by inviting Diane.
Mildred and my mom hung out pretty often. Mildred's house was large, built in the 20s, I suppose. It must have been the first in the neighborhood, and later the neighborhood was built around it. Across the street, my side of the street, everything was built in the 50s, and throughout the neighborhood, that was the general sense. We were a post-war, modern neighborhood. Mildred and her family had some special status, though, with the oldest and biggest house and the largest yard and the most detailed, picture-perfect landscaping. Now, every house had a nice yard and nothing trashy anywhere within a significant distance. In short, it was a picture-perfect place. From the top floor of Mildred's house, I could look down on my house and describe the obvious prairie school design with a low-pitched gable roof and broad eaves over simple garden beds of Japanese influence, high windows all across the front, and an unusual main entrance on the side instead of the front. Our picture-perfect house was set among dozens of picture-perfect houses of other styles, no two looking the same. Now, placing our family into the picture, it would still look perfect, almost. There would be father and mother and four children, three of them white and one other. In our picture-perfect neighborhood, we didn't acknowledge this difference. There was a general agreement, apparently, not to mention it. And inside my almost perfect family, we learned nothing about the origin of my oldest brother, except that he was adopted when my parents thought they couldn't have children. They discovered otherwise immediately afterward when my sister was born. And then they forgot about this whole having children thing for 10 or 12 years, and my brother and I came along, unplanned. So the four kids were in two age ranges, and collectively we were multicolored. The collective will of the neighborhood just ignored the details, and the singular will of my mom encouraged that. I imagine, though, that an observer in mid-60s Boise, Idaho, might have assumed that we were some kind of enlightened family, unencumbered by the limitations of the pre-civil rights era, ahead of the times, you might say, open-hearted, open-minded people living the American dream, picture perfect, almost. When I was in second grade, I drew a picture of my family, and I can remember it as if it was right here, right now. My brother had gone to war. On the far right side of the picture was this little figure. That was me. And I was the youngest. And then my close brother was just a little bit taller. And then there was a gap. And then my sister. And then, oddly, my mom and dad, each one slightly taller. And then towering over us all was my brother in his shiny navy whites and that goofy hat they had to wear and his beautiful dark skin glowing as best you can with crayons. He was my hero. When I was 8 or 9 and he was doing his second tour in Vietnam, I asked my mom why he looked so different. I knew what being adopted meant. I mean, that's easy to figure out. But I wanted to understand more. Where did he come from? How come he looks different? I'd never seen her evade a question so well. But as some of you may have come to learn about me, I am inclined to be persistent. That's not a new quality about me. Eventually, she relented, but this is all she said. Well, you know he's adopted. There's no way you're going to look alike. He's German. Right? I didn't laugh, but I was stunned. Like, what? I knew without a doubt that she was not being truthful. Such a bizarre claim. I learned something about my mom, but it took a long time to figure it out. But a few years later, I began to understand more when she, for some reason, was telling me about a nightmare she'd been having about the country club, you know, the picture-perfect country club. She was worried about the possibility of changes in the rules that would allow people of all races to join the picture-perfect country club. She feared in her dream, as dreams are, that all the colors would blend together in the swimming pool and everyone would become the same. Dreams are odd that way. They hint at the stories behind the stories. By the time my brother returned from Vietnam, I had felt I had an enlightened attitude of colorblindness. It doesn't make any difference. This is what I understood. I held that for many years, feeling rather superior to some people. And then I figured it out. I mean, my friends came in all colors, and by this age, many lived in the same picture-perfect neighborhood. My own brother was no different than other vets who had served multiple tours in Vietnam and came back damaged in both body and spirit. And I don't think he knew that he wasn't white. The stories my mother created were strong, and it was easier to comply than to defy. Self-deception is very hard to overcome. Far ahead, long after my parents died, my spouse and our 6-year-old son were featured in a human interest story called A Simple Christmas. We spoke of the simple traditions our young family had made meaningful for ourselves, and when asked about our motives, I spoke of my youth, when we had to make things look perfect. It was a prime directive to us as children. No matter what was going on, if the doorbell rang, we had to answer with gracious smiles, and the house was always ready in case Better Homes and Gardens showed up to take pictures. I really think my mom thought they might. I told the reporter that holidays in my family growing up were horribly stressful behind the scenes. The tension ran high on the calmest days. The consequences of imperfection were harsh. It was the stress of preparing for a Christmas one year when all the nearby relatives were coming to our house that my dad almost died from the stress, and I resolved to banish such from my life as much as possible. With our son, then, we had attempted to have simple and calm holidays, genuine emotions instead of perfect performance. I lost the ability to affect a smile unless it was genuine, so when you see me smile, there's never a pretense behind it. I don't know how to do that anymore. I lost the need to have everything look perfect all the time. You can look at my car or my house and see that. When the Simple Christmas article was published, I got a call from Mildred. Remember Mildred? She was livid, and she shouted into the phone, "But your family was perfect. Your mother worked so hard to give you a perfect life. I'm ashamed of you." I hadn't thought of it, really. But then I realized just how good we were at playing the parts. Even Mildred hadn't seen what happened behind the scenes. I wanted to point out that she was basically proving my point, and yet mostly I was sad that this spare adult who was frequently at our house, closest to our family, had never known the real story. "There's a story behind the story, Mildred," I thought to myself after she angrily hung up. "There's a story behind the story, always."
Back in December, when we had our service auction, Mary Ann was either the lucky or the unfortunate one, but anyway, she bid on having me, since we didn't have a minister at the time. She got to choose the sermon. And so the topic today is something that Mary Ann feels very strongly about and came up with. And I think that it's very timely as far as the things that we deal with today. So thank you for this opportunity to preach on this topic today. 5 years ago, a noted psychologist, Arlene Russell, went down to Lake Charles, Louisiana, to see if she could scale the empathy walls. And she wanted to look at what separated her from the many Americans who had joined the Tea Party movement and most recently had came out as supporters of Trump. And she wanted to apply her feelings of a psychology of emotion to the discontents that had led to the recent drift in American politics. And so she spent these years in Louisiana trying to understand the deep stories of these people, and she learned that their deep stories focused on the American dream, the idea that if you work hard and play hard by the rules, you can have a better life. But she learned another lesson that I think that applies to each of us when it comes to our own deep stories. Our deep stories are the stories we tell ourselves to capture our hopes, our pride, our disappointments, our fears, and our anxieties, and sometimes even our misbeliefs. Such was the case with the story that John had been telling himself about Muslims. They took the hatred out of me. That's what John Duckner, a 61-year-old house cleaner in Omaha, Nebraska, recently admitted in interviews with both the Washington Post and KETV. He told the Post that he had been one of those guys who would want to put on a pig's head on a mosque and sneer at women who were wearing a headscarf, even though he had never actually met a Muslim person before. Then six families of refugees, including some from Syria and Afghanistan, moved into his apartment building. They were Muslim. His previous neighbors had been loud, messy drug addicts, and he had found living next to the refuge families a surprising relief. He learned about their harrowing stories about escaping from war-torn countries, and slowly but surely his feelings about Islam and Muslims warmed. The Muslims here were all about family, and they just loved everyone, he told the Post. I remember the people who lived there before. They took for granted everything this country gave them. These people, they really changed my heart. After 3 months of being here, they all have jobs, they have cars, their kids are going to school. They took the hatred out of me, he said, with tears welling up in his eyes. I never knew how badly someone could hate someone they don't even know. John Duckner took the time to connect with his neighbors on a deeper story level, and it changed his life and his views. Think for a moment what happens when we can take the time to connect with the deeper story. What lessons can we learn about ourselves, our interactions? What can we choose to do differently because of learning the deeper story? I'm reminded of the great radio host Paul Harvey in his weekly broadcast. I always look forward to listening to it because he would start out sometimes naming a person that we'd heard about and we'd known about and thought we knew. And then he would proceed to say, now the rest of the story. And he would then, for the next 3 to 5 minutes, proceed to share a story about this person. And by the end of his sharing, I was always amazed at the new information that Paul had shared about this famous person. And many times the value judgments and thoughts I had previously formed about the individual were changed by the very fact that for 3 minutes I had been introduced to a deeper story about them. Now think for a moment of those times in your own life when you had formed in your mind a judgment about a person or a situation, and then you were presented with additional information about either the situation or the individual. How did you feel? Did your initial judgment change? Recently, I had the experience where a judgment I had placed upon a family member changed. I don't know if any of you have had to deal with friends, family members, or neighbors who, given the recent change in the political landscape, have found it hard to engage these individuals in a conversation. But such was the case with my oldest brother. He and I are separated by 15 years, and many times through the years, this has been a challenge in itself. But last fall, when my brother told me he was supporting Trump, our rocky relationship even became that much more challenging. Things became so contentious between us that I had to tell him that I couldn't have contact with him until after the election. Along with many of you, I was surprised and worried about the results of the election. But in January, I thought it was time to resume my contact. And since I was going to be in Chicago, and since he lives there, I decided to reach out to my brother. Arranged for us to meet for dinner, and preparing for the dinner, I reached out to several of my seminary colleagues and asked them if they would be willing to be silent support section in the restaurant a few tables away. And I told them that I needed to be them to be present and help me to maintain my perspective and my calmness and my deep listening. And so they agreed to this, and we all arrived at the restaurant at the same time, and they were seated several tables away from me, and my brother had no idea that this group of seminarians were actually watching everything. But as my brother started in with his usual rhetoric, and I felt the hairs on the back of my neck rise, and my emotions started to get all stirred up, as I'm sure many of you can relate to when you try to talk with these individuals. I wanted to start yelling back at him. "You don't understand. How can you believe that?" Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I looked over at my seminary colleagues and made a choice just to listen, to be present. It was not hard to interrupt him, but it was hard to interrupt him, but I just listened. And for the first time, I tried to understand what he was saying, how he felt, the way that he did, and I sat there and was present for him. It wasn't easy, but I listened, and then a wonderful thing started to happen. His rhetoric began to change from that of having to defend himself, of that of wanting to be heard. Then it changed from wanting to know how I felt and how I was doing. It took a while, but by the end of the dinner, we had found some common ground where we could agree on. And more importantly, we talked about our relationship and the need going forward to do a better job of keeping in touch. I listened to his deeper story, and from that, found a deeper understanding and a way to connect with him. I realized that in many ways, we both wanted the same thing out of life. He valued family and friends just as much as I did. He was concerned about his country just as much as I was. I realized that night that even though I didn't agree with his points of view on many things, that we do share some common ground where we can meet. Sometimes in trying to come to deeper understanding of stories, it does require us to look back and look to the past for understanding. And such is the case of a story that's been told many times that happened right here in this community. You know, on May 4th, 1970, members of the Ohio National Guard fired into a crowd of Kent State University demonstrators, killing 4 and wounding 9. And that impact has been dramatic on this community and even on this congregation. But the event triggered a nationwide student strike that forced hundreds of colleges and universities to close. And in the 3 decades since, the literature has been developed analyzing all the events of the May 4th and the aftermath. But despite that And the misinformation and misunderstanding continues to surround those events. But the shootings at Kent State and that part of that deeper story need to be remembered for several reasons. First, they came to symbolize a great American tragedy which occurred at a period in which the nation found was deeply divided both politically and culturally. And second, the need for healing continues to exist today, even as it did then. And healing will not occur if events are either forgotten or distorted, and it's important to continue to search for truth behind those events. And third and most importantly, Kent State should be remembered in order that we can learn from the mistakes of the past. May each of you be reminded of the importance and the need to learn the deeper story, such as John Dutcher, the 61-year-old house cleaner in Omaha, Nebraska, when he learned about Muslims and realized that they took the hate out of him. Or may you be inspired to reach out to a family member, a colleague, a neighbor, to listen to what their deeper story is. And may you remember the stories from the past right here in this community and the impact that they have and the lessons that are there. As we ponder the meaning of deeper stories in our lives, my challenge to each of you is to always be mindful that there always is and always will be a story behind the story that's deeper, that requires us to be present, to ask questions, to be in a place of love. In the words of the prophet Muhammad, I leave, making friends with people is half the wisdom, and asking good questions is half the knowledge, and listening for understanding for the deeper is where the learning happens. May it be so.
Underneath the surface,
hidden down below,
there's a story waiting,
waiting to be told.
And deep inside the story,
there's wonder to behold,
passion, joy, and sorrow,
gifts as pure as gold.
Every rock and every stone, a thousand voices find a home.
Every seed of every form
awaits a secret to be
born.
So listen for the whisper
rolling thunder all around you.
If you do, it'll turn into
a memory to hold.
Listen for the rocks, trees,
and the bumblebees around you.
Everywhere you know that there's
a story to
unfold.
Underneath the surface,
hidden down below,
there's
a story waiting.
Listen,
listen,
listen.
Reach out and take the hand of the person close to you. And may this day you go forth and remember that there always is a deeper story. And with that, May that bless your life and your family and this community as we come together each week. Go in peace.